everybody. Welcome to Season 2 of Great Minds, People and Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Brenna Kinsey, Chief People Officer of Advertising Week and Emerald. Today's guest is Diana Brooks, leader and owner of The Third Eye. The Third Eye is a woman-owned, independent, full-service health and wellness ad agency that creates impactful marketing campaigns to change behaviors across audiences in the U.S., including multicultural and underserved communities. Diana is a trailblazer in the advertising industry. Her strong belief in empowering others to make health-conscious decisions fueled her passion for marketing healthcare services. For over 30 years, she has led and executed highly successful marketing campaigns that resonate with healthcare brands and consumers. Welcome, Diana.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, nice to have you. Nice to see you.
For having me, I'm very excited.
Excited as well. We have lots of great things to talk about today, but I want to start us off with the story that you guys shared with me about the adversity you faced very early on in your career.
Okay, well, actually, it's interesting that you say that because I think that it started even before I started my career. When I decided to go to college, my first desire was to really get into the film industry and be a director. And I attended the University of Miami, which at the time had, you know, one of the best film schools in the country. And I did about a semester and a half worth of classes. And then it was time to really pick which lane I wanted to go in film, whether it was going to be production or art direction, screenwriting, editing. And I remember sitting with my advisor at the time saying that I wanted to be a director. And he just kind of looked at me stunned and said, "No, you're a woman. You can't be a director. So you need to find another route to take." And that was something that when I look back on, what I think amazes me the most is that I just took it at face value and said, "Oh, okay. So let me go ahead and look for another major." So because I was always in this creative space, that's where I really leaned into graphic design and advertising. But I can tell you that was really the first time that I was taken aback that, you know, my gender was going to impact any future career that I had in film. And obviously this was in the mid to late 80s. So, you know, I'm very excited to see today how that's changed. We still have a lot to go, but I definitely am proud to see it changing.
Well, mid 80s was not that long ago. And there was someone who told you could not be something because you were a woman.
And I look it on the chin. Exactly. That to me was, I think, you know, I look at my daughter today who also just graduated from university. And I think to myself, my God, if somebody were to tell her that today, it wouldn't fly. You know, it would just be unacceptable. But, you know, back then it was kind of like, OK, well, this is, you know, a male industry. Therefore, I'm going to go this route. And ironically, I ended up in advertising, which at the time was also a very male dominated industry. But I felt that because I was on the design side, that I would be able to at least contribute there.
And what inspired you to start your own company?
That's funny. I think that what inspired me was that I started my career working as a designer, and I kind of moved throughout different positions. And at the time that I was working in the industry, there was history kind of is repeating itself today, but you had a lot of small independent agencies that were being acquired by holding companies. And for me, I went to two agencies that had started as very strong creative strategy. I want to say they were, you know, mom and pop, you know, today it would be small to mid-size organizations, and both of them were acquired. And going through those acquisitions, and, you know, I'm not here to talk bad about holding companies, but I just really didn't like the immediate shift in culture that happened. I felt that it kind of lost a lot of the creativity and kind of like the human element of like sitting with clients and trying to figure out what their marketing opportunities or problems that they were having, challenges. And I felt like all of that was like hidden behind layers and layers and layers of BS, pardon my language. So I think it was a lot of fearlessness, terror, arrogance, you name it. I mean, I was 24, 25 years old, and I literally went to my boss who had just gone through this acquisition. And I said, listen, you know, I don't like this culture anymore. I just want to get back to the basics. Please hold my job for a year. I'm going to go out there and try to make it on my own. And, you know, I think that the main reason why I was able to really get my company off the ground was because I had a lot of mentors that, if, for example, there were smaller clients that went to these agencies that were too small for a holding company and their fees, my old bosses would be recommending me to them. And that was pretty amazing considering that I was, you know, a 25-year-old who literally was arrogant enough to say, hold my job, I might be back or not.
That's incredible. And they supported you.
They supported me. And it's funny because, you know, they did. And I started getting very small, like almost mom and pop type companies. Then there started really becoming this whole investing in tech. And, you know, there were new market opportunities growing. And I would say about 10 or 11 months into kind of knocking on doors, literally, because at the time, you know, we didn't have LinkedIn and we didn't have anything. You were just, you know, showing up at offices with donuts, begging for a meeting. You know, I was busy enough that I went back and I stole the CD, who ended up being my business partner she just retired in 2021. So we were together for 25 years. And, you know, I remember that we took out a $15,000 mortgage on her house. We bought two Macs, a fax machine, a phone line, and literally worked in her kitchen for almost 2 years before we actually got an office. And, you know, if I look back, it was still the funnest time.
That's pretty badass. Was it always called Third Eye? So this is how Third Eye originated?
No, actually, that's a great question. When we started it, what we did find was at the time, you know, that whole mid-market size company or smaller that was looking for marketing needs, you know, they really couldn't go out and afford a true agency. So my very first name was called the Advertising Department. And the reason why we called ourselves the Ad Department is because we would kind of morph into an extension of whoever our clients were and serve as their team. But I'm going to tell you that as creative as we were, it confused the hell out of everybody, because when we would call and say, oh, this is Diana from the ad department, they were like, who? From what companies? So needless to say, you know, we had to go through some different evolutions of names. And then actually when my business partner retired in 21 after COVID, we had been VS Brooks, which was a combination of both of our names. She actually said, you know, now I think it's time for you to really build a brand that is representative of you and who you are. And I'll tell you that at first I was very nostalgic and melancholic, and, you know, I didn't want to let go of that. But in hindsight, my partner was right, because I kind of had to like, now say, okay, this is the new agency. You know, yes, we've been in the market for almost 3 decades. This August, we just celebrated 28 years. And we did our rebrand in 21. And, you know, it's been great, because I feel that in going through the process of rebranding, it gives you an opportunity to really look at, you know, what are your values today? What is your mission and vision? And how does all that keep you relevant as an agency in this industry that is literally changing? At this point, I feel like, you know, what is Ad Age going to send me next within the same day in terms of a new change? So
I love that story. What are the values and the mission of your company, of you in general? Because I assume we built the company based on more values and your mission. So what are they?
So it's interesting. I think that the values of the company are very much a reflection of me. We have four, and it's heart, honesty, hustle and humor. And I think that the one that honestly is most important to me more than anything is the fact that we have to have humor, because with humor comes creativity. And I always joke that, you know, we're not brain surgeons. We're not, you know, curing cancer here. We're working in this business where it's all about creativity and big ideas and reaching consumers. So if you come in and you take yourself too seriously, or take this industry too seriously, that's not where you're going to get the best ideas. You have to be able to laugh at yourself, at one another, at the ideas. And then, you know, I think honesty is probably the second one that I find to be the biggest priority. It's funny, I tend to be a person who has no filters. And if you were to probably ask my repertoire of clients, they would say that that's what they love and hate the most about me. But interesting enough, one of the goals that I strived for always from when I started my company was, whatever investment my client was making in marketing, we took it as seriously as if we were investing our own money. So we came to the table as true partners in wanting to make sure that the investment, you know, had good ROI, had the right strategy behind it. And if I didn't think that was the case, I would tell people. And some clients appreciate that, and some people were kind of like, oh, she's a little bit too much.
But you've held on to those values, and very obviously, and you've built a company culture around those values.
Yeah.
How do you build that culture? How do you hire for it? I mean, you know, I know you're a woman founded and woman run. Like, what did that mean? How are you hiring for the heart, the hustle, the honesty, the humor, and then how do you cultivate it? Because these are not always the values of most companies, or the values that we wish all the companies have, but you don't always find them. So how do you cultivate that?
You know, you said something that I think is really critical to everything that we've really cultivated at the organization. And for me, work-life balance, as it applies to women in particular, has always been consistent throughout our decades now, because we're predominantly women, we're women of color, and we are all mainly young people that are starting their families. And it's funny because my business partner and I, when you know, and she was older than me, we both grew up with this attitude of, you know, we have to work longer hours. We have to, you know, work harder. We have to be able to be competitive enough to go against our male counterparts. And I think that what happened is that in that process of just trying to always be, you know, competitive and trying to stay, what I'm going to say, up to speed, in that process, we were forgetting about emotional labor. And, you know, emotional labor, both professionally and more importantly, personally. And, you know, both my business partner and I, we each had one child, and it was really important for us to say, okay, wherever we work, however we build this organization, everyone has to come in knowing that their personal well-being is what's at the forefront. And, you know, that for me was really important. You know, I literally drove myself into the ground when I was in my 20s and probably in my late 20s. I had a full nervous breakdown. I was so, you know, I started very young. I had to prove that just because I was young didn't mean that I didn't have experience and knowledge. I was a woman, not only in a very male-dominant industry, but in a community like Miami that is very strong Hispanic. Very, you know, patriarchal. So I felt like I had all of these things working against me. So I had to be more, and I had to be perfect. And, you know, I had to be the perfect mother and the perfect boss and the perfect, all of these things just kind of led me to a point where I was like literally on the ground saying, I can't do this anymore. And that was when it really shined upon me, you know, going back to these values that are so important. That, you know, everybody that we interviewed, we wanted them to make sure that the organization that they were joining was definitely a safe space for them and a place where they could be themselves, that they could find mentorship, that they could find support and collaboration where, like, historically, I've always gotten rid of mean girls. You know, I grew up in an all-girl Catholic school. You know, I made sure that the mean girls, you know, were always kind of removed from the equation, because to me, it was so important for everybody to be able to express themselves. And through that expression and having that open door, I know that people use open door policy a lot, but for us as women, you know, we can't help it. You know, we're all up in each other's business, whether it be family, friendships, all of these things. So it was really important that when we hire people, I will tell you that for us, we look at, will they be a cultural fit? Will they add more to the culture in a very positive way versus what their experience or what their actual knowledge or skills are? Because those things can be taught. But fitting into the culture to us is much more of a priority when we're going through the hiring process.
I love that. You know, something you said made me realize that, sorry, is there a lot of background noise?
It's okay. Don't worry.
No, it's okay. I just want them to stop before I get it. Okay, perfect. No, I lost my chance. So I'll go back to the questions. Sham, can you share an example of a significant change that you as a leader face and how you successfully navigated it?
So, you know, I thought about that. Because I think just because of the amount of years that we've been in business, we have definitely faced a lot of hurdles, whether they have to do with world events. You know, we went through 9/11. We went through recessions. We've gone through so many very large uncontrollable factors in the business that one of the things that I have always prided us on is, you know, we have to focus on the things that we can control. And what are the things that are really important to making sure that we're protecting not just the culture of the organization, but the people. And I think that if I had to pinpoint what was probably the most difficult for us was, it was very recent. It was coming out of COVID where, you know, like all agencies, we were going through this, you know, drastic way of working and this new way of being. And because we specialize in the healthcare space, we were very busy during COVID. And we had a particular client that will remain nameless that, although they were a very profitable client, they were a very toxic client. For many things, there were no boundaries. There was an expectation of being on 24/7. There was no real prioritization of work. There was no true partnership. It felt very much of, we were just a vendor. And what I saw happening was that it was literally ruining the culture of the organization. People were no longer happy coming to work. People were no longer, you know, there were a lot of tears. There was a lot of frustration. There was a lot of tension happening between departments, which I wasn't liking. And it came time for the account to come up for review, and we declined the incumbency. And it was very hard. It was a very long decision that I had to make. It represented probably 50% of my total revenue. And I had to sit back and say, well, you know, I can't put money first, because if my people are tired and unhappy, my productivity goes down. So when we made that decision, and I made it with, you know, my key leaders, and, you know, it was going to have very serious implications on the organization. We were basically going to have to implode the entire office and start over. You know, we were going to have to right size. We were going to have to let a lot of people go. I think a lot of agencies tend to structure themselves around whatever their biggest client is in terms of processes and billing and all of those things. And we just had to say, you know, screw it. We're just going to start from scratch. Hardest decision I've ever had to make. And, you know, we're almost 2 years after making that decision. And obviously it's been a very tough climb. However, I literally go to bed every night saying that was the best decision that I made for the agency. And it's funny, if when I look around and I see my people and my teams all working back together, and that culture has come back, and that sense of pride in the work that they're doing, to me, you know, there's no price tag to that for me. That's just not who I am. And sometimes you have to make those decisions. You have to say, you know, what's more important?
I just don't think a lot of people are doing those brave, bold moves like you are, where you continue to choose your values and your team and your talent over your bottom line. So I think that's incredible. And
thank you.
Obviously.
And I will say that came, and I will tell you that that came from what I saw at a very young age, when I saw two companies that I worked for that had very good cultures literally be decimated in 6 months. And I said to myself, I can't be that person. You know, I can't sleep at night.
And how do you foster a sense of belonging among your employees from different backgrounds? And what initiatives have been the most successful in empowering underrepresented groups?
You know, it's really funny when I'm asked about inclusion and DEI and all these questions, because to be very honest with you, you know, I'm Hispanic. I'm a woman. I don't know how to think any other way but DEI. So, you know, it's really interesting to us when, you know, yes, we're minority certified, we're a women-owned business. We have all of those, you know, things that companies like to check off when they're working with agencies. But the truth of the matter is that if I look at my organization as a whole, and we're about 35 employees, give or take. We're predominantly women. We are predominantly of color from different Hispanic, different countries. We come from different parts of the world. And I feel that it's just a very organic process that we go through, that, you know, like we joke that we've got one white gringa, as we call her, you know. So that's our version of diversity and inclusion, really. But the truth of the matter is that because it's so fundamental to us, there's a lot of things that we've put in place to make sure that is always, people always have like a sense of belonging. So, you know, I think one of the big ways that we do that is obviously through we have ERGs. Where, you know, those are not driven by anybody in leadership. Those are initiatives that employees can take to create an LGBTQ group. I mean, we have a group called, you know, the Mommy Mafia, that they're all soccer moms, and, you know, they do therapy about how to deal with working and dropping their kids off at soccer. We have book clubs, we have sneakerheads, we have all different kinds of groups, and we're able to kind of let everybody have a place to express themselves. We're very big on mentorship and shadowing. I think it's really important that the younger people that start with the organization really get to work with all the different, you know, key leaders and departments, not just professionally, but personally, to kind of see, you know, how things go about. We do a lot in making sure that we work with vendors that are also minority-based, which I'm not going to lie. I think that because we work in Miami, which is such a, you know, a cultural pot to begin with, it's very easy for us to make sure that the groups, but everything that we do, whether it be hiring talent, you know, we're very strict in terms of making sure that we're representing all groups when we're doing any kind of creative campaigns. We work with vendors that are also representative of different groups. And I think that, you know, because it's so much a part of who I am as an individual, and then on top of that, we're creatives. So you've got to bring in that whole level of, you know, weirdness. You know, you know, let's face it, we're a very eclectic group of individuals, to say it in a very nice professional manner. So I think that, you know, it's hard for us to kind of look everything we look at.
DEI and representation is just organic. It's in our DNA. So for us, it's just very authentic to make sure that we're always looking at making sure that everybody's feeling that they are represented. You know, in my mind, it's like, it's 2024. What the hell, guys? We should be already there. But, you know, I see it. I see clients that sometimes will be invited to RFPs just because we check off certain boxes. And that's something that, you know, I kind of laugh at, but I also am like, hold on a minute. It's, you know, we're way too ahead as an industry that DEI shouldn't be part of our assets.
Can you give us an example of a successful project or campaign that you and your team worked on that resulted from all of those innovation and collaborative culture?
Yes, I think that if I were to look at a successful project, I don't want to say that it's one campaign in particular, but I think it's a process that we have that I think is very unique that was actually developed by my chief strategy officer, who's one of the, you know, three men in my organization. But I am a firm believer that big ideas and good ideas can come from anywhere in an agency. At the end of the day, we're all consumers. And at the end of the day, we're all out there experiencing life and shopping and being and seeing messaging, and we're on social media and all of these things. So I have always been a very big advocate in making sure that it's not just the creative team's responsibility to be ideating. So he came up with a process that we love to call champagne campaigns. And what we do is this is usually a half day session in the mornings when people are fresh, and we have champagne and mimosas, which is probably not very PC, but you know, hey, it inspires us. And everybody from every department, and when I say every department, I'm talking finance, analytics, production, AM. Everybody who would usually not be in this ideation world, what we do is we give them the let's say we're going to work on a campaign. What we do is we give them the objectives. We kind of give them the parameters of the brief. And then we let them break apart in teams and actually come up with different ideas. And then they have to present it to the rest of the agency a la Shark Tank. And I can tell you that in the last 2 years, most of the campaigns that we have presented have come out of these champagne campaigns where they've come from different people. And, you know, at the beginning, it was really funny to watch because when we started this process, a lot of the people who traditionally were not in that role felt very intimidated and didn't want to speak. And we realized that by making them be the ones to actually stand up and pitch the ideas to the rest of the agency, those people are now the ones that are most excited to really participate in these champagne campaigns. And now, by the way, it's gotten out of control. Now it's like teams and we dress up. And I mean, now it's just chaos. But I think my whole point of that is everybody loves being part of the beginning of a campaign and then seeing it come to life. And that kind of engagement, I think, is priceless because all of a sudden I've got everybody with eyes out on, you know, where the campaign is, what are competitors doing. We get feedback across the board, and it's just really special, and everybody really loves it.
I love that idea. It's so cool and so fun.
It's so fun.
The minute you started explaining it, I was like, oh, Shark Tank with champagne?
Oh, the last group, my team was blue team and we dressed up as sharks. And I mean, we just take it to like the whole extreme. But the whole idea was, you know, my team had a project manager, a finance person, a media person, and myself as creative, right? And that's what's so great is that people who usually don't get a voice at the table to talk about, because that's always the fun part, you know? So it's a lot of fun. We really enjoy it. And it's really become something that we tested. And it's been a huge success.
I love that. I also love that. I think on your website, it says something along the lines of, You are a team of manifestors and you're using your good energy to create the world that you all want to be a part of. What is...
Hence the third eye. That's where the name comes from. Yes, exactly.
What are you all manifesting for this year and beyond?
That's a great question. I think that our mission is to take care of brands that take care of people, pure and simple. And in my mind, I and my team are really manifesting the ability to work with brands that want to be innovative, really do care about taking care of their members. Again, I said, you know, we're in the health and wellness space, which today, you know, there's been a lot of jokes around what wellness means today versus what it was prior to COVID. But this whole concept of really manifesting brands that want to make an impact, a positive impact in people making the right health choices, and also being able to work with brands that want to be innovators and want to stand out. I feel that a lot of times in the past, we have worked in more traditional lines of healthcare, what we like to call institutional healthcare category, but I would really love for us to be able to work on things that are impacting positively women's health. You know, that's a huge issue for me because I still feel that it's one of the most underinvested in from a capital perspective overall. You know, I don't want to get into politics, obviously, but this, you know, we're living in this very scary moment where, you know, we're looking at the potential of a government that's telling women how to use their bodies or what they can do to their bodies. And, you know, that's for us as a group of so many women, it's really important for us to manifest, you know, where can we make a positive impact within women's health? And honestly, what I'm manifesting is that we continue to be able to work in an industry that still values and represents the importance of big ideas. I feel that during COVID, what we saw was the trend was everybody was really kind of rolling up their sleeves and leaning into brands with purpose. And you saw all of these brands before talking about, you know, how we had to, as human beings, you know, live together. And there were all these positive things that were going on. And now what I've seen is we've kind of, you know, everything works in a speculum. So I think we went from like really high purpose branding to now very lower funnel tactics, TikTok shop, Amazon, you know, and, you know, then you've got all of these things being thrown in there. You know, how is AI going to impact us? How is this going to, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's still all about educating consumers about making good choices. And I would really love to see our industry kind of cut the BS around all of this other stuff, because at the end of the day, the way that you can make an impact and can break through is by really connecting with very creative ideas. And, you know, I hope that we can use that muscle a lot more as women of color in the industry.
What advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
Honestly, I think that when I was in my 20s, the biggest thing that held me back was fear. You know, I was so scared of failure. And I always kind of held back because I was so scared of failing. And I feel that if I could go back and tell myself that failure is growth and that with every failure, I got better and I learned more and it was a part of the process, that would have taken away a lot of the fear that I had to probably even be more bold in the decisions that I made. I felt that a lot of times my own fear of failure, not just as a person, but as a company and what my clients would think, that always held me back. But now, you know, almost three decades later, I realize that if I look back, the things that I remember are my failures and what I learned. I don't remember so much. I've had a ton of great times and I'm very happy for those. But if I really look at what were big
pivots or changes or catalysts for growth, it was always failing. So I really would love for people that are my age to understand that that's part of the process. And believe it or not, it's actually the best part of the process, is being able to kind of pull yourself back up and say, you know, what did I learn from that? How can I do better? And let me move on. You know, don't wallow in it. Don't, you know, you just got to kind of pick yourself back up and say, okay, well, I'm not going to do that again. Let me make sure that I learned that lesson. So that's really, for me, what I think is really important. You know, we're in a creative business, and I feel that because of that creativity, there's more vulnerability and more selective thinking, that I think we're also more forgiving when we make mistakes versus other industries. So don't be scared.
How can clients who want to join you in this manifestation to create a purposeful campaign find you?
Well, I'm definitely on LinkedIn. I love writing thought leadership pieces, and you can always find me at Diana Brooks at The Third Eye. You can also visit our website, thethirdeye.com. And, you know, that's probably the best way to get in touch with me. And I would love to be able to speak to any of these brands that are really looking for, you know, a very diverse and eclectic group of creatives that are always looking for new solutions for brands. So that's the best way to find me.